Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 372. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Go on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. Well, believe it or not, it has been 5 years since the historic repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And to commemorate that occasion, we bring you this week's incredible guest. Let me introduce him. Rob Smith is an openly gay Iraq war veteran. He is a journalist, and he is the author of the number one bestseller, Closets, Combat, and Coming Out, Coming of Age as a Gay Man in the Don't Ask, Don't Tell Army, which was the recipient of the 2015 National Indie Excellence Book Award for LGBT nonfiction and a nominee for the 2015 Lambda Literary Award for Memoir. He has spoken about veterans' issues and LGBT rights and empowerment all across the country on college campuses, pride events, corporate functions. In 2015, he received the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association Award for Excellence in Blogging, and he recently received the 2016 Gay City News LGBT Impact Award for multimedia coverage of issues impacting the LGBT community. So many more accolades, but then we wouldn't have time to chat, so let me just say, Rob, welcome to This Show It's So Gay.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was a lot, Rob.
It's a lot. It's a lot to listen to. It's a lot to read. but it all happened, and I'm so thankful and happy that it all happened.
Well, we have so much ground to cover, sir. Are you ready?
Absolutely. I'm so ready. Let's go.
Well, let's indeed start with that veteran status of yours. Talk to our listeners about that decision to join the Army.
Well, as I say a lot, you know, when I'm speaking in the book, I'm from Akron, Ohio. So I'm from Akron, Ohio. It's a very, I'm from a lower middle class background. It's a very working class place. It's the rubber belt, right? It's what they call middle America, real America, whatever you want to call it. And also, neither one of my parents are college graduates. And, you know, when I think back to when I was 17 years old and in that mindset of joining the military, I knew that I needed to do something. And I really wanted the opportunity to go to college at some point. And the military was an option. The military was an option to get me to college eventually. The military was an option to get me out of Ohio. And the military was an option to kind of jumpstart my life in a way that I really wasn't able to at that point, even at 17 years old.
Yeah. How do you go about describing your experience being in the Army? How do you wrap your mind around that?
I mean, when I, you know, when I was writing the book, I went through a very intense, because, you know, when you're doing nonfiction, you get the proposal and you get that all out there, but then you actually have to write the damn thing.
Right.
So I sat down and I wrote it for about 3 months straight. I really did nothing but write the book. And I was really, you know, I had a kind of a guide map in terms of where I wanted to go and what I wanted to talk about. But I was also kind of reliving all of these experiences as I was writing it. And not only was I reliving these experiences, filtering them through the age that I was at the time when I was writing the book, but also trying to get into that mindset of a 17-year-old black gay kid from Ohio that is in infantry basic training that eventually, you know, deals with 9/11 and deals with the Iraq war invasion and dealing with going to war. And I think that how, you know, you get into that mindset, how I wrote it was to just put myself back in the mindset of where I was at that time and to try to be as descriptive as possible, to try to bring people in as much as possible, and to try to make it as relatable as possible. And the one thing that I did not want to do with this book was that I didn't want to write a book that was kind of about what an awesome person I was, because I was flawed. I made some of the wrong decisions from time to time. And it's a very human story, and I tried to let the humanity come through.
What was your first recollection, your first introduction to Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
You know, my first introduction to Don't Ask, Don't Tell was, as a matter of fact, it was probably when I was signing the paperwork to enter the military. You have a day when you've taken the test and you're going down there to get sworn in and everything, and they literally ask you point blank if you are gay. And I don't think at that point in time, at 17 years old, I don't know if I was self-identifying as gay yet. I knew that there was something there. I mean, I knew that I was attracted to men. I didn't know if it was a phase. I didn't know what it was. But I knew that if I said yes, then I wouldn't have been able to go into the military, and I wouldn't have been able to make this move that I really wanted to make for my life. So, you know, I had to lie. I had to say no. And after that, my experience with Don't Ask, Don't Tell was I had a very negative coming out experience with my mother very early on. I came out to her by accident over the phone, and she just was not welcoming, was not kind. It sent me into a tailspin. I write in the book about how much I almost killed myself. And I knew that I couldn't go to a chaplain and I couldn't talk to anybody else on the base about that, because I knew that if I did, then I would be, you know, going against the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law. And I would be in danger of getting kicked out.
Yeah. I would imagine it's just this thing that kind of hangs over you, and I kind of want nothing to be hanging over the head of any of our brothers and sisters who are serving in the military.
Absolutely. I mean, it is, and I think that when I look back on it, it was this thing that was hanging over my head, but also it was something that stopped me, I think, from developing the relationships that maybe I could have developed with some of my fellow soldiers at the time. I'm still close. I was close with a couple people, and I'm still in very active contact to this day with people that I served with via Facebook. God love Facebook, right?
Right.
Still in contact with a lot of people that I served with, and there are some people who are aware of my activism and who are very much aware of what I've done that I served with, and they all have Facebook messaged me and emailed me and all this stuff, and they said, hey, you know, we kind of figured that you were gay, we kind of knew that there was something else going on there, but, you know, you got to understand, man, we never really cared. We just knew that, you know, you were a good soldier, and we trusted you on the battlefield, and we trusted you with you know, keeping everything in line and protecting them as much as I trusted them to protect me. So you don't want anything hanging over your head. And I think the best thing about Don't Ask, Don't Tell being gone is that there's like this whole generation of soldiers now who don't have to be afraid. And there's, I think that there's definitely still some unfinished business with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We can definitely go into that eventually or a little later.
Yeah. Well, you skipped a little bit of a step there. Before we get to that repeal, the year is 2010. In my mind, you were just kind of walking by the White House and you got arrested. Is that what happened?
That is actually not what happened.
No, no.
So the story about the White House protests and those photos, which, you know, a sidebar about those photos is that I really do hope that they kind of have a life of their own when we're talking about LGBT history, because it is LGBT history.
Yeah.
What ended up happening with White House protests was that I remember I was speaking at Virginia Tech, and I got a Twitter message from a woman named Robin McGee.
Okay. Oh, yes, of course.
At the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she said, you know, we're going to do something at the White House. We're going to do an action on Monday, and it may be an arrestable action. And when she said arrestable action, I kind of stopped and paused, and I said, well, what does that mean? That means that I could possibly get arrested for doing something. And then that's kind of like a gut check moment, because right. I was thinking to myself, okay, you know, so I'm speaking and I went to the lobby day and all that stuff, but am I really ready to get arrested to, you know, face the possible legal repercussions that come with that? And I really struggled with that for the weekend, but I called her back and I said, you know what, I'm going to get out to D.C. I'm going to do this. And it was an amazing thing to be around her, to be around Lieutenant Dan Choi, to be around all of the other, you know, soldiers, veterans, and also just civilian activists that I got arrested with.
Yeah.
When we were protesting, we were thinking about, you know, what we're going to do. We're going to chain ourselves to the White House fence. You know, some of us, the ones that are veterans, got in uniform. I remember we had our handcuffs right, you know, kind of on our wrist, and they were kind of hidden in the cuffs of our shirts. And we just walked down there and we just did it. And there was just this throng of press. I mean, all the kind of press that you can imagine, because back at that time, Don't Ask, Don't Tell appeal was a really big deal, and Dan Choi was just this huge sort of larger than life figure.
Huge.
But I really think that we took those steps because it was highly possible that the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal bill, in the language that we were fighting so hard to get passed, it was possible that was in a whole lot of trouble, and that may not have happened. So I think that I can speak for everybody else that was on the fence that day to say that we like to believe that we were a part of the push to get that passed. And not only were we a part of the push to get that passed, but also we were a part of so many different pieces that had to come together to get that passed. There had to be people that were lobbying, you know, in Congress. There had to be the activists like us that were very vocal and very public about putting that across. There had to be so many moving parts that worked in order to achieve that one common goal. And that's what I like to say, because everything is not always about Congress and lobbying, and that everything is not always just about direct action like we took. You know, all of these different things have to happen together.
But if your family's listening, let's just say the official story is you were walking by and you got arrested.
That's the official story.
Yeah, I'm fine
just
with that.
Just in case my family's listening.
I would imagine, though, that's quite, as you said, that's quite a decision to make, and it's not one that many of us think about. What am I prepared to get arrested for? What is important to me? Talk to us about how you were able to vocalize in your mind, yes, this is a core issue for me.
I think that for me, what I was really thinking was, okay, so I'm a Black American, and if I was alive during the civil rights fight of the 1960s, you know, would I have had the guts to stand up? Would I have had the guts to march, to boycott, to do sit-ins, to do all that stuff? Now, I don't know. I mean, I would like to think that I would have had those guts. But when I was sitting and thinking in that hotel room, I was thinking that this is a civil rights moment. This is a moment where I have the experience and I have the power to the power to really make a change. And that was huge to me.
Yeah.
And it was a step that I just really had to take, because I went through so much being closeted in the military. I went through so much in terms of dealing with potential suicidal thoughts and a suicide attempt and dealing with being in combat and all of those different things. I knew that if I could make an experience easier for a gay soldier in the future, then I'm going to do whatever I need to do that. And I think that can be tied to everything that we go through as LGBT people. You know, the generation that's older than me paved the way for me to come through and to live my life openly and authentically. And this was a point where I really wanted to do something for the generation that was coming up under me.
I love it. I love it. Now, I am pretending in my head, and I need it to be true, that you, Rob Smith, remember exactly where you were when you heard that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was going to be repealed.
I do. I remember exactly where I was. I remember, this is a very funny story about how I came to be in the room that day and actually to speak very briefly with President Obama and shake his hand. I remember reading on, I think it was an America blog at the time. I was sitting at home. I was living in Harlem at the time. I lived in Harlem for years. But I was reading that, yes, this was going to be repealed and that this was going to be a big ceremony. They really wanted to make a big show of this and that it was going to be at the Department of the Interior. You know, there was going to be a signing and everybody was going to be there. Now, normally they do these types of things in the Oval Office, and it's really a very, very limited group of people that can be there. You're literally talking maybe 10, 11 people. So I find out that a bunch of people are going to be there, you know, like Dan Choi and all the Get Equal people are going to be there. A lot of the bloggers, the people from the LGBT blogosphere like Joe Sudbe and John Arvosis and a lot of people like that were going to be there too. So I found it was going to be a bigger thing. So I pulled every string and every connection that I knew of, okay, to try to, you know, get on the list to be there for the signing of this repeal. And somebody ended up putting me in contact with the person who was the LGBT liaison to the Obama administration at the time. And this person put my name on the list. So I'm like, okay, great. Now I have to get to D.C. Mind you, I'm in New York. And mind you, this thing happens in the morning. It is at this point, it is maybe 6:30. Now, I run downtown. There is a 7:30 bus that's going to D.C. From Midtown. I remember throwing a bunch of stuff in my bag and just racing down to the bus and texting a fraternity brother to see if I can crash on his couch while I was there. And I was able to get on that list. I was able to get there, and just being there for the signing of that repeal legislation is probably one of the greatest moments of my life. And it was one of the moments that I felt the most connected to this community, because there was such a huge sense of collective achievement. And we have made so many strides as a community, but there are very few moments where we have that sense of collective achievement. You know, one of them was, of course, a couple of years ago when we finally got marriage equality in all 50 states.
Yeah.
Right. So that was a huge moment. And I feel like for me, before marriage equality happened, that was one of the biggest collective moments for LGBT progress that I had experienced in my lifetime.
Huge. It was huge. Again, listeners, we are here with Rob Smith, journalist, author, veteran. You alluded to it earlier, and we would be remiss if we did not cover it. So 5 years since the historic repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but we cannot sit here right now and say there's not still work to be done, correct?
No, we can't. And you know, one thing that I've been saying for years and years and years is that there were a lot of things that were going on when we were working for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And the legislation that actually ended up being passed was, some people may call it watered down. I say that it wasn't the optimal legislation, right? And the one thing that was missing from that, not only was transgender service, right, because we are just now getting to the point where we're going to have open transgender service in the military very soon, and we're prepping for that right now. But what is still missing, even though we're on the cusp of transgender service, and even though it's been 5 years since Don't Ask, Don't Tell implementation, is there is still not a non-discrimination policy in place in regards to sexual orientation and gender identity in the military. So what that means is this. If I'm African American, or if I am Jewish or Muslim or any other religion, or if I'm a woman or anything else, there are protections in the military code that protect me from discrimination, right? So I'm protected if I feel like somebody is racially discriminating against me. I'm protected if I feel like somebody is discriminating against me on the basis of my sex. Those protections do not exist for sexual orientation or gender identity right now. So theoretically, yes, LGB soldiers, soon T as well. So theoretically, LGB and soon T soldiers can serve openly, but they're still not protected from filing a claim for discrimination, right? So they're still not legally protected from being discriminated against in the way that people are based on their race or their religion or
right.
gender.
Yeah.
Which is still a huge problem. It's still a huge thing that needs to be addressed. And it's something that's kind of been swept to the side. I don't know if it's something that people are still thinking about. But I think that it's a gaping hole in Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal and all the progress that we've made.
All right. Well, should you be walking by the White House again, and should you perhaps have some handcuffs around? I'm just saying, you could make another stand.
Maybe I could. Maybe I can make another difference.
Well, let's change gears here a bit, because you are immersed in the wonderful world of journalism. And from what I am understanding of your story, this came from you really pursuing a dream of yours and making a pitch.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so my transition into journalism, right, it is an extension of the activism that the LGBT activism that I started becoming involved with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because a big part of the way that I was advocating for Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal was that I was writing pieces about my story. So like I was writing for The Advocate and I was writing for Salon, and I got very involved in media and learning how to write and learning how to share my story in that way. And after the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal happened, I made this transition into journalism because I felt like it was a natural transition. And I also talk a little bit about it in the book. You know, the desire to be a journalist and to get into this industry was something that I had for a very long time before, even when I was serving in the military. I remember during the road to the Iraq invasion. I remember watching CNN and all these news networks and all that stuff every day to kind of get more information about what was going on, because, you know, I was a soldier. They weren't telling us anything.
Right.
And so this work that I'm doing now is kind of a natural extension of that. I've reported a lot on issues about the LGBT community, but I've also reported a lot on veterans issues as well. And I report a lot about and do a lot of reported and opinion pieces about politics. And I really feel like in journalism and in media in general, there are certainly not enough LGBT voices, although there are plenty, but there are really not enough veteran voices.
Yeah.
And there really need to be more veteran voices in this industry reporting on these issues.
And can we also mention the dearth of voices of color, of which we need so many more?
We do. We need so many more voices of color. But you know what? I will counter that by saying we do need voices of color, but we also need to give people of color in the journalism industry the space to write and report and explore things that have nothing to do with race and identity as well.
Yeah.
Because I feel that sometimes in this industry, especially in journalism, we will have, you know, the black person anchoring, or we'll have the black voice, blah, 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 but they will only be there to be the black voice.
Right.
Okay. And so they'll report on racial issues, or they'll do commentary based on what their experience is as a black man or as a Latina woman or whatever it is. But when it comes time to report on the quote unquote real issues, we always have to have like that straight white dude there.
Yeah.
And I think that how we break through that is for people of color and for LGBT people to actually be leading that conversation, kind of in the way that Don Lemon does on CNN. I know Don Lemon gets a lot of flack, but what you have is an openly gay black man who is leading the conversation and reporting on these issues. He's not there to give commentary about what his life is like as a black gay man and then be sidelined when it comes time to report the real issues.
Yeah.
And there needs to be so much more of that in this industry. And I'm telling you, I finished up at Columbia University about a year and a half ago, thanks to a veterans program as well. But I am on the ground level working in this industry, and there need to be more of us. There need to be more LGBT people. There definitely need to be more people of color.
So important. You had some pretty significant experiences this summer covering some political conventions, did you not?
I did. I was I pioneered coverage of the Democratic and Republican national conventions for NBC Out, which is a new LGBT-focused arm of NBC News. So they sent me out there, and those are some very interesting experiences.
As I sit here right now, close to your hometown, as we broadcast from Cleveland, Ohio, the very interesting thing is, if we go back, you've written about gay Republicans, and then you're here in Cleveland trying to find them.
Yeah, I was. And what I was most surprised about, the reaction to some of the pieces that I'd done for NBC from the Republican National Convention, is that what I was shocked about was that people thought that I shouldn't even be covering this at all, right? So the fact that gay Republicans exist is something that should not be talked about, should not be covered. And I said, okay, well, if I'm going to both of these conventions, I need to go get some stories. And, you know, a lot of people may not love gay Republicans, but they do exist. And a part of this work that I'm doing as an LGBT journalist in this industry is telling these people's stories in as best a way I can. And it was very interesting to talk to basically gay Republicans, because I did cover Caitlyn Jenner, but of course Caitlyn Jenner wasn't giving any interviews. But it was very interesting to talk to gay Republicans about Donald Trump, about what they think about the Republican Party, about what they think about other gay people. It was quite fascinating, and I hope that some of that was reflected in the work.
Yeah.
And it's not reflective of any of my political opinions at all. What I'm doing, I do a mixture of commentary and straight-up reporting. Everything that I did in both of the conventions, that was straight-up reporting. My opinion was not in that at all. I was there to ask the questions and cover the story. And there, I'm telling you, from a story that I did about the gay Republicans voting for Donald Trump to Peter Thiel, you know, being one of the keynote speakers at the Republican National Convention, they had an enormous presence in that party. And just being there on the ground at the Republican National Convention, there was a fairly standard gay presence there.
It was something to behold. Again, I live about, 1.5 miles from the Q. I walk downtown all the time. And to encounter gay Republicans, which I thought were unicorns, but they're actual people, and they had views, and they were present. They were very present here in Cleveland.
They were very present. And, you know, this is one of the things that I say, even as, you know, as a black man, as a gay man, walking around the Republican National Convention, I think that when we see the Trump rallies from, you know, middle America or wherever, it gives us kind of a skewed sense of what's really going on. I mean, I didn't really feel unsafe at the Republican National Convention. I really didn't feel like anybody was looking at me a certain type of way. The thing about it is that there was a lot of media there.
Yeah.
There was tons of media. And most of the people that were attending were politicians. And, you know, politicians say things to rile up their constituents and their base. And those things may or may not be exactly the truth of what they believe. We'll just put it like that.
I think that's pretty fair. Yeah.
But to compare the Republican convention, which was one thing, to the Democratic convention, which was actually, personally for me, it was more fun to cover because there I was covering the Democratic National Convention as well as the Equality Forum that was happening at the same time. So I got to cover a lot of LGBT events, a lot of LGBT people of color events, a lot of LGBT Democrat events. They had the largest number of trans delegates ever at the Democratic National Convention. I got a chance to be there in the room where they did a photo op for that, and it was just, it was really amazing. And it really did feel like I said, I don't skew too heavily towards either party because, like, I think that if you're a journalist and if you're American, you have to realize that both parties are pretty much full of crap from time to time. But being at the Democratic National Convention was pretty amazing. It just felt like progress to me.
One of my favorite pieces that you did there was you spoke to LGBT voters. See, I feel like we've spent a lot of time, not just on this show, but in the media, because they're an underrepresented group, and I hesitate to say that about gay Republicans. And so a lot of questioning of gay Republicans, hey, why are you Republican? But not a lot of people speaking intentionally about why they are both an LGBT voter and a Democrat. And you really got at the heart of that. What did you learn from talking to those folks?
I mean, I learned that they were, number one, everybody was very excited to be there. I think the piece that you're referring to is the Why I'm an LGBT Democrat piece, which you can find on NBC News, NBC Out. But I think what I found that people were very excited to be there. And what people felt as LGBT Democrats is that they felt that they were on the right side of history. And they felt like they were on the right side of progress. And I got a very strong sense of that from everybody that I talked to for that piece, because I think maybe 8 or 9 people made it in that piece, and I must have interviewed probably 10 or 11 more that didn't make it into it. And I got the sense that people felt proud to be LGBT Democrats. They felt like they were on the right side of history. And what I felt when I was speaking with gay Republicans at the RNC, and also when I'm speaking to gay Republicans just for regular, you know, stories that I do, there is a defensiveness to them. And I know why there's a defensiveness, because they're on the ropes and their loyalties are always being questioned.
Right.
But people seemed very happy to speak about why they were Democrats at the DNC.
Oh, good stuff. What is coming up that's exciting for you, Rob Smith?
What's coming up that's exciting for me is doing more work with NBC Out. There are a couple of, there is one thing in particular that I'm working on with them that I think is going to be great if we can get it together. And also doing more work with a company that I'm also working with right now that does a lot of work in the digital realm. So I'm going to be working with them to develop digital series. Some things may be about politics. Some things may be about LGBT issues. Some things may be entertainment oriented. So I'm just really excited about the future. And also I'm excited about doing a little bit more talking about, you know, Closets Combat and Coming Out, of course, which is available on Amazon.com right now. And, you know, working on the next book project. So hopefully we'll have that to talk about here in the next year and a half or so.
You're doing all of my pitches for me. There's not a lot I can do that's left because you've done all the pitches. But let me start over for our listeners. Listeners, this is what you need to do. Stroll on over to robsmithonline.com. And right there, you got all your social media links. You can certainly click on that great word book, and that will link you up to get a copy of Closets Combat and Coming Out, which you most certainly want to get a copy of that. I will tell you this, Rob Smith, and I don't always get to say this, you, sir, are doing really good work. It's important work. You are using your voice to make a difference, and it's really great to see.
No, thank you so much. And I mean, you know, you are doing good work as well. I mean, I think that we're both openly gay voices trying to kind of make a difference, trying to give people a voice and trying to give people an outlet. And I appreciate the outlet, and I also appreciate what you're doing as well.
And to be clear for our listeners, they can still do good work if they're not from Northeast Ohio, right?
Maybe.
But,
you know, it's us Northeast Ohio boys that are doing the best work.
Rob Smith, please keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much. You do the same.
He was a famous trumpet man from out Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was a top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowin' reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. He didn't blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he could not jam. The captain seemed to understand, because the next year the cap went out and drafted the band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. A root, a toot, a tootie, a tootie.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have tons of time left on this week's episode, so let's get to all of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. First, a little bit of a plug. I know that you guys are listening all around this great country and some international folks as well, but I did want to give a shout out for something that's happening here in Cleveland. If you are in the Cleveland area or able to travel to the Cleveland area, total plug here for the show Ruthless. It's playing at the Beck Center for the Arts. It's playing through October 16th, and also it's brilliant. Totally LGBT themed. It's all about musicals. It's very campy, very, very funny. My partner and I actually saw it in New York City a few months ago. We saw it off Broadway, and this production at the Beck Center for the Arts, so much better than the off Broadway one. So I encourage you to go see Ruthless. There is a drag queen part in there that must be seen to be believed. You can just stroll on over to Beck Center. .org. I urge you to go see Ruthless. So there you go. Now, here is the funny thing about doing our little gay radio show. I feel like I will cover a story and then we record it, we edit it, we put it out there to you all, we're done for the week. I would say about a minute and a half after I post it to our website and each episode goes out to syndication, the story changes dramatically. And that's what happened last week. I reported on last week's show about the profile of Milo Yiannopoulos, the alt-right, horrible, horrible guy, the profile that Out Magazine did of him. Now, full disclosure, the profile was written by Chadwick Moore, who's been on our show three or four different times. We love Chadwick Moore and the work that he does for The Advocate, for Out Magazine, but this piece just felt so wrong. It felt like it was glamorizing this guy. Now, there was a disclaimer at the top of the profile saying we are not endorsing the views of Milo Yiannopoulos. No, you couldn't possibly, because he says horrible, horrible things. He says incredibly transphobic things. He says incredibly racist things. He says incredibly misogynistic things. He is not a representative of our community. He is just about getting media attention. And so for Out Magazine to give him the column width and these really splashy, glossy photographs really just didn't feel right at all. So when I recorded the show last week, I was starting to get the sense people don't seem to be very happy about this. No, people were, as it turns out, really not happy about this. So as of last Friday, over 80 members of the LGBT media signed on to a letter reprimanding Out Magazine, twice as many who had signed on as the day before when I recorded the show, three times as many as when that letter was first posted. The condemnation was widespread. It was growing. Many LGBT journalists who answered requests for comment by the Advocate, they didn't call for a specific consequence for Out. Instead, they said that they wanted discussion and change that lasts past this moment. So Out Magazine described Yiannopoulos as a, quote, professional mischief maker and provocateur. Well, the open letter from the journalist said that this piece was dangerous and a puff piece. Zach Ford, the LGBT section editor at Think Progress, he was one of those who spoke out against the magazine on Twitter, but he's also the one who decided to do something more, and he put together this open letter. He said that this profile represented a, quote, serious problem. He said this, quote, "This puff piece, complete with a cutesy clown photo shoot, makes light of Milo Yiannopoulos' trolling while simultaneously providing him a pedestal to further extend his brand of hatred." Further said this, quote, "This is a moment that simply symbolizes how bad erasure and negligence can get, a clear-cut example that is just inexcusable." Zach Ford did stop short of calling for a retraction, public apology, or more. He said this, quote, "Would anyone actually believe if they issued an apology? I honestly don't know how exactly you walk this back." Zach Ford also highlighted, as I have highlighted, the very indignant and quite obnoxious, I know I'm editorializing a little bit here, tweets from Aaron Hicklin, who was on our show years and years ago. Aaron Hicklin is the editor-in-chief of Out Magazine, and he posted these tweets that were just so condescending, saying it was really the reader's fault, not Out Magazine's fault. And so Zach Ford did call that out, and he said this, quote, "Besides Aaron Hicklin's indignant tweets over the past 2 days, including one that specifically referenced the letter, suggest Out Magazine might be a lost cause anyway." Aaron Hicklin tweeted this, quote, "To be clear, Out has always honored LGBT diversity, highlighted its struggles, and celebrated the richness of its intersectional cultures." There you go. So I probably should have said this at the top of covering the story. I actually did sign on to this letter, which was a big decision for me because I very much believe in freedom of the press. I very much believe in covering some unpopular figures in our society. I believe in that. I think it's important to highlight these voices. But to give them column width to continue spewing their hate and make it seem acceptable, that I'm not okay with. And I don't think that's responsible journalism. We can get into a larger question of what is journalism. That's where I've been struggling a lot here, these blurred lines between, well, they're a news outlet. Out Magazine, not a news outlet in any way. And also, I think that Chadwick Moore is amazing, and I think that he writes incredible pieces. He did incredible work highlighting some of the stories that came out of Orlando after the Pulse nightclub massacre. He's done incredible work profiling people who are living in Russia under a particularly oppressive regime for LGBT people. He's done incredible work profiling wives of husbands who have transitioned genders. Really important work. This piece, though, it really missed the mark. So there you go. That's it for Out Magazine, Milo Yiannopoulos. This all happened right after I uploaded to our website last week, and that's the way it's going to work, which is fine. Let's update you on the latest North Carolina. I feel like it would not be a normal week on This Show Is So Gay if we didn't update you on what's happening in North Carolina. Well, the newest news comes out of California about North Carolina. California has now banned non-essential state-funded travel to North Carolina. This week, the California legislature signed into law AB-1887, which prevents government workers from traveling to the Tar Heel State on official business. The bill was passed in, of course, response to House Bill 2, North Carolina's discriminatory law that forces transgender people to use public restrooms in government buildings that do not match their gender identity. It also blocks local legislatures from enacting their own LGBT protections. Along with banning travel to North Carolina, it also bans travel to any state that allows discrimination against the LGBT community. The California bill could also restrict travel by college sports teams to North Carolina, as the decision applies to the California State University system and the University of California. This would be a huge blow to North Carolina after the NCAA, NBA, and ACC all pulled upcoming games from North Carolina. The Southern Conference of Basketball, which includes colleges like Samford University, University of North Carolina at Greensboro, Mercer University, and the Citadel, they are all expected to follow suit. This is a huge deal. AB 1887 would also impact conferences and trainings held in North Carolina, which are a huge source of income. All of our professional organizations, when they have their conferences, that's a huge source of income. And we saw this in Indiana, right? We saw that when Governor Pence, by the way, let's remember, this was Governor Pence. Let's not just say, oh, all the things that happened with the Religious Freedom Protection Act in Indiana, that was under Governor Pence, the current Republican vice presidential candidate. He was in the mix. He was at the forefront of it. So when they passed their Religious Freedom Protection Act, I know that for my own professional organization, NASPA, the National Association of Student Personnel Administrators, there were a lot of conversations of, should we still be going to this state? Should we still be funneling our conference monies and our tourist dollars to this state that says not everyone is treated equally here? That doesn't feel right at all. Well, that was a big conversation in Indiana, and that was one of the reasons that they amended their policy. Because Indiana said, we do not want to lose all of these dollars. We need to amend the Religious Freedom Protection Act. That does not seem to be happening in North Carolina. And North Carolina, they are losing money. Indiana, it was about the threat of losing money. I don't know that they lost a ton, except in not having a very good reputation, which does not help for your tourism dollars. But North Carolina, they are actively losing money. I'm so sorry yet again, all my brothers and sisters who live there in North Carolina. Here in Ohio, let's do an Ohio story. A judge in Ohio has shot down a bid to discriminate against trans people. Well, that's great. Ohio's Highland Local School District had filed a lawsuit to challenge federal protections put in place by the Obama administration. The Obama administration, just to remind you all, had intervened on trans rights earlier this year after a concerted anti-LGBT campaign to stop transgender people from using public bathrooms. Well, the Department of Education, following that intervention, wrote to every school in the U.S. to advise them that they are obliged not to discriminate against trans students. Well, the Highland Local School District, because apparently they have so much free time, they took this all to court to defend their ban on one trans girl using female bathrooms and locker rooms. The school district argued that the girl, who has not been identified, good, is not discriminated against as they are permitted to use a unisex staff toilet away from other students. Incredibly, the school district argued in court that allowing the student in the girl's bathroom would put others at risk. However, her lawyers contend the school is putting the girl at risk by refusing to recognize her identity. Judge Algernon Marbley, the United States District Judge for the Southern District of Ohio, ruled that there was no evidence to support the student being banned from the student bathrooms and no suggestion that they were a threat to anyone else. The judge said this, quote, other school districts that have encountered these very issues have been able to integrate transgender students fully into the academic and social community without disruption and certainly without the doomsday scenarios Highland predicts, such as sexual predators entering an elementary school restroom. The court finds no merit in third-party defendant's argument that the other students would be harmed by allowing Jane, that's her pseudonym, Jane, to use the bathroom consistent with her gender identity as other students already do. There you go. So yeah, no, this elementary school girl, not a threat to other students. Thank you to Judge Algernon Marbley, both for having an incredible name and also for deciding in this way. Let's talk about another judge, not as good of a judge as Judge Algernon Marbley. That would be Alabama's Chief Justice Roy Moore, still the Chief Justice in the state of Alabama. He appeared in court this week to battle ethics charges brought against him over his crusade. It is truly a crusade against gay weddings. After the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of equal marriage last summer, Alabama's Chief Justice Roy Moore tried to actively disregard the rulings, issuing a number of judicial orders to officials in a brazen attempt to re-ban gay weddings. He declared the Supreme Court rulings, they don't apply in Alabama. That's kind of scary. He said that due to Alabama state's anti-gay laws and ordered probate judges to enforce a gay marriage ban. But he soon learned the hard way, you can't actually just ignore what the Supreme Court says. He was indefinitely suspended after the Judicial Inquiry Commission launched action against him for his string of illegal orders, and he is facing a trial on the allegations that he flagrantly disregarded and abused his authority. Well, he appeared in court this week. He doesn't really have much of an argument. He's claiming that he is being targeted for his religious views, while opponents say action is being brought about because he ignored federal court orders and established law to pursue his own petty agenda, trying to block gay weddings. Now, ironically, there's one law firm that's doing well. He is represented by the same law firm as, you guessed it, Kentucky clerk Kim Davis. That's really a niche market that this law firm has come up with. They represent Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore and Kentucky clerk Kim Davis. There you go. That is a niche market. So that is what's going on in legal news. Let's do some international news. Kenya's moral policeman, Ezekiel Muchua, has been granted a diplomatic visa to enter the United States. He will travel to the U.S. to attend the Web Rangers Summit in California, which is a Google-organized convention concerning online safety. He said this, quote, because of my stand on moral values, including the banning of content promoting LGBT and atheist culture in Kenya, someone wrote in a local daily newspaper that I will never get a visa to the United States. Well, I not only got it, but I came on a diplomatic passport and I didn't even have to go to the embassy for a biometrics or pay the visa application fee. America, here we come. To God be the glory. So there are a lot of activists that are very upset about the fact that he is coming here. You know what? It is what it is. I don't know how much traction he's going to get here, and we do have that free speech thing going on. And again, by the way, I can hear someone saying, well, then what about Milo Yiannopoulos? He has free speech. Of course he has free speech. But we also, as the LGBT media, don't need to be dedicating space to these folks. We don't need to be giving them the platform to spew more of this. So the fact that this Kenyan guy is coming, fine. That's fine. But we don't need to now say, and here's your front page article in Out Magazine. That's ridiculous. That validates them. That humanizes them in a way that they do not do for other people. Some really crappy news out of San Francisco. A gay man was left blinded by pepper spray for 3 hours after he and his friend were attacked by 5 other men in San Francisco. Neil Frias and Jeff White from New York were attacked last weekend. The two 28-year-olds were celebrating an annual leather-themed LGBT party at the Folsom Street Fair when they were attacked around 9 p.m., and it is being viewed as a hate crime. It is being investigated that way, so we will see what happens with that. In baby news, I love baby news, a baby has now been born with 3 biological parents for the first time ever. The New Scientist magazine broke the news that a 5-month-old boy was born using a new technique that incorporates DNA from 3 parents. The boy was born to Jordanian parents thanks to pioneering work from John Zhang and his team at New Hope Fertility Clinic in New York City. The couple had sought help as the mother carries the genes for Lee's syndrome, which is a fatal disorder that affects the developing nervous system that was responsible for the deaths of her first 2 children. Well, using a technique known as mitochondrial replacement, doctors were able to extract the nucleus from one of the mother's eggs, inserting it into a donor egg with the nucleus removed. Why are we carrying the story? Because this will have huge implications for how LGBT people conceive children in the future. Gone might be the day where we say there's one biological parent and then one adopted parent, or at least it's starting out that way. So that is going to be a very big deal, and we'll see what happens with that. In my favorite story of the week, it's not a happy one, but it just amuses me. A Christian graphic designer in Colorado is suing for the right to discriminate against gay clients who don't actually exist. Lori Smith, a self-identified graphic designer who claims to create custom wedding websites in the state of Colorado, she filed a lawsuit this week in a bid to demolish LGBT rights protections in Colorado's Anti-Discrimination Act. In the lawsuit, which is backed by the anti-gay evangelical group Alliance Defending Freedom, Smith claims that she is at risk of action because she would not feel comfortable serving gay clients due to her religious beliefs. But bizarrely, the law does not specify that any gay couple has actually asked Smith to provide her services. So she is actually postulating this. She's doing a preemptive strike. She is posing a hypothetical future scenario. This woman is so nervous, I don't know what adjective to use, let's go with nervous, that gay people might ask her to develop a wedding website. She is so nervous about the potential for being sued, I guess, by saying no. She is spending money to launch a lawsuit as a preemptive strike. Wow. That actually takes an amount of free time that not everybody has, and also a lot of money that not everybody has. She thus becomes my favorite story of the week. She's launching a lawsuit to prevent people who don't exist. There's no one asking her right now for her services. She just wants to make sure it never happens. There you go. Well, although that might be my favorite story for the week because it amuses me, by far the most awesome story of the week, the most awesome story of the week comes to us from space news, actual space news. So LGBT rights have now crossed another barrier, only this time it's the atmosphere. Planting Peace, which is an activist, amazing rights activist group, they just used a weather balloon to launch the rainbow flag into space. They released a statement that said this, quote, on October 17th, Planting Peace sent the first pride flag into space and in doing so declared space LGBTQ friendly. Space is now LGBTQ friendly. Not just like the space in your office, outer space. The statement continued, quote, the primary purpose of this declaration is to support the ongoing fight for the fundamental human rights of our LGBTQ family, moving us closer to a universal understanding that all people deserve to live freely and love freely without fear and discrimination. To achieve this, we used a high-altitude balloon with a GoPro attached and launched just outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The pride flag was airborne for just over 3 hours before making its way back to Earth. At its peak altitude, the flag soared 21.1 miles above the Earth's surface. Our hope was to create the largest safe space possible for our LGBTQ community. It also offered us a chance to reinforce in a peaceful, beautiful way our ongoing message to our LGBTQ family. You are loved, valued, and beautiful. There is nothing wrong with you. You are not alone, and we will stand with you. That's the end of that statement. Aaron Jackson, the president of Planting Peace, told the Huffington Post this, quote, it was an honor to send the first pride flag into space, and it provided a wonderful opportunity to show that Planting Peace will not stop fighting for LGBTQ rights until all sexual and gender minorities experience full fundamental rights in every corner of the universe. The backdrop of space gave us a stunning, inspiring, and peaceful canvas for our message of hope for our LGBTQ family. I would love for LGBTQ children who are struggling to see this and look up to the stars and remember that the universe shines brightly for them and they are not alone. You have to go see pictures of this, folks. You must. Just search activists launch a pride flag into space, and you can see this incredible picture of the pride flag miles and miles above the Earth. And so it's very cool. Space is now LGBTQ friendly. I love it. Other incredible news, Ben Smith. Ben Smith will have run 10,500 miles, the equivalent distance between London and Sydney. this is all in a new campaign of his to use his voice in his own way to make a difference. In this case, he's using his whole body. He is a 34-year-old equality campaigner. He is finally heading home to finish his 401st marathon in 401 days. Holy cow, 401 marathons in 401 days. Ben Smith said that he made the epic journey in a bid to raise awareness for young people who are bullied and targeted specifically for being LGBT. He came up with the idea after years of homophobic abuse at school, which resulted in 2 suicide attempts. The campaigner also suffered a mini stroke at 29, which he partly blames on his treatment at school. During recovery, he was encouraged to join a running club by a friend and found that it helped improve both physical and mental health. Since coming out as gay, he decided to focus his efforts into raising awareness on the damaging effects bullying can have on young people. He said this, quote, "The work against bullying and saving people from suffering long-term problems because of being bullied is important, and I firmly believe we have made a positive impact on so many people's lives." He's doing this over in England, 401 marathons in 401 days. He ran his first marathon on September 1st, 2015, and since then he has run, this is so unbelievable, 10,506.2 miles, again, the equivalent distance between London and Sydney. Over 8,000 people have joined him on his marathon so far, and he wants you to join him on his last stretch by signing up to, and you can just go to the 401challenge.co.uk. Can you imagine? That's a very unique way of using your voice to make a difference. It's such a great thing. And we have to celebrate people using their unique ways to make a difference, especially on this week, because guess what, folks? This week is the 8th birthday of This Show Is So Gay. We launched at the beginning of October in 2008. I never in my wildest dreams would still imagine we would still be doing this 8 years later, much less speaking to the incredible folks that we get to speak to who are using their voice to make a difference in their own unique way. Just incredible folks. Of course, like Rob Smith heard earlier on this episode, he is doing incredible work as a veteran, as a journalist, as an author. So keep your eye out for Rob Smith. And you know what? Keep an eye out for you, because you need to go look in the mirror and figure out what it is that you do to use your voice in your unique way to make a difference. I don't know what it is. I've heard from a couple radio people this week who are doing incredible things in radio, which makes me so happy. So that is literally using your voice, but maybe you're using your pen, you are writing that letter to the editor. You have to do something. If you have strong opinions, let them out, let them be known, however it is that you best do that. It will make a difference. It will make you feel amazing in the process. So happy 8th birthday to This Show Is So Gay. Thank you guys for listening. Get out there, go make a difference. And while you're using your voice to make a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
In boogie rhythm, he can't blow a note, less than bass and guitar is playing with him. And the company Johnson, he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. He was some boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. When he played boogie woogie bugle, he was busy as a busy bee. When he played, he made the company jump into the bar. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. He puts the boss to sleep with boogie every night and wakes him up the same way in the early fright. They clap their hands and extend their feet, 'cause they know how it goes when someone gets the beat. Whoa, whoa, he breaks it up when he plays reveille. The boogie woogie bugle.